Welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Jeff McMullen. Jeff is a journalist, author, and filmmaker, and his work includes many decades as a foreign correspondent for the ABC, reporting for Four Corners, and also as one of the original presenters on 60 Minutes. Much of Jeff's film work over the past two decades has focused on the human rights of the First Peoples, the impact of the Northern Territory intervention, and the chronic illnesses taking many lives. Jeff, welcome back to Dads on the Air.
Well, it's good to be talking with you again, Bill. I've been rambling a lot since I saw you all over the map.
Well, it is great to have you back here, and this time there you seem to have walked in on a lot of current issues. Among those, I suppose, are the proposed voice to Parliament, there's sovereignty, prospects of a treaty with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, and education. But let's go with health. You've been focusing lately on fetal alcohol syndrome. Is this a particular threat to Aboriginal people?
It's a particular threat to all Australians being born in the era where we don't really have enough knowledge to understand what we're doing. It's a good example of how voice is essential for the well-being, really, of everyone, every individual, every family, and then the broader well-being of the society. Because I've been working over the last 2 years with the best medical knowledge in the world, and much of that is Australian, on this subject, and yet, as yet, I don't think the country understands that there are so many babies, even in utero, in the first trimester of pregnancy, that are actually being set up with a disability that they will pass on for a couple of generations. So fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is the scientific name that we give to what happens when alcohol actually moves through the fetus and in the early embryonic stage. That tiny formation of life inside the mother is often impaired by an unknown amount of alcohol. We can't reliably say at what day or what part of the pregnancy or really how much alcohol does this damage. But we do know that as early as day 18 after conception, some unlucky mother and father may, through an accidental night of drinking, maybe two nights of drinking in that first trimester, could indeed set up an impairment that has passed on for a couple of generations more. It's astonishing to me that we don't really have the public health prevention program, and that's what I've been working on, Bill, now to try to get in place.
What are the symptoms if someone is born with this spectrum disorder?
Well, what happens is in that very early stage, the brain is impaired. So the baby is born with a disability that shows out in all kinds of ways. Sometimes there are some physical signs that doctors might identify, but it's not essential that you can have this damage without some of those traits. So it's difficult to pick up unless you have a skilled set of indications, but as the baby grows, it becomes clearer that hearing can be really significantly impaired. So often we see children later in schooling who are being diagnosed as perhaps having otitis media, the old glue ear that doctors and teachers have known about for years. A lot of that hearing loss could also be attributed to this early damage to the brain of that infant. But then the impulsive behaviour. When you see children who unsettle their brothers and sisters. They run riot at school. They might be on the roof of the school. They seem not to respond to any discipline. And this is because their impulsiveness has been wired in from that damage to their brain. So the kids are not bad children. They are simply showing the consequences in their behaviour of, frankly, our behaviour as parents. You know, the mother and father's alcohol consumption pattern does affect the brain of that infant. As the kid gets a little bit older, you get to the much more serious issues. The impulsiveness, where the child cannot understand what is going on, can lead on to violent behaviour. It can, it doesn't always, lead to such disorientation that it might lead to criminal behaviour. Now, I've got to tell you, in the juvenile justice centres that I'm asked to go into, usually by a mother or a father or an Aboriginal elder, a lot of those kids, black and white children, that are in detention should not be there because they have an unrecognised brain impairment. It was estimated, Bill, in Western Australia, of about 100 young Australians in the Banksia Hill Detention Centre, a third of them are fetal alcohol spectrum kids. So we have the evidence that this is a widespread pattern, and it is global. It is really a human story that is not yet fully understood. And my own personal confronting discovery was to learn from a Californian scientist that if my wife were to have a little girl who was impaired in this way, and then that little girl, when she grows up, has another little girl, and then that little girl has another little girl, you've got three generations of impairment to motor skills, to learning, to retention of information through loss of memory, and ultimately you create these impulsive, seemingly uncontrollable children that through no fault of their own are set up for a very, very difficult life. So the knowledge is there. What we've got to do, Bill, is get it into those high school education classes in the very early years. We need to be braver. We need to teach quite young girls that bottle of wine or dad's beer at the bar is in fact something that cannot go with the whole season of having children, of having babies. No one is suggesting you've got to take alcohol off the table altogether, but you've got to realise, if you put it in a positive sense, if you want a beautiful, healthy boy or girl with all of the opportunities that are here in Australia, you've got to realise alcohol is a toxin.
It's interesting that perhaps fetal alcohol spectrum disorder has been largely associated with Indigenous issues, whereas, as you've just explained, it's much broader than that. But looking at Indigenous issues, you've been involved with them for some 20 years. Do you think there have been some real improvements? I mean, you look at Welcome to Country, Aboriginal languages being studied, the spokesman like Stan Grant, Indigenous representatives in Parliament. Do you think there has been some real improvement, or are we just looking at a veneer?
Well, the theme that you introduced at the outset of Voice is the key to this. You just mentioned Stan Grant. The eloquence of Stan's discussion about racism, or where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders sit now in this nation, shows you that it has a massively influential impact. The educative value of any Indigenous person trying to explain what it is like to be oppressed for over two centuries is always going to do far more than government policies. So my response to your question, really, I guess I look at it in a quite different way to most of those politicians discussing constitutional recognition. I look at it in a very personally challenging test. Will anything that we're talking about really make things better for any one of those children that are going to be born in Australia this year? And the truth is that there is evidence that shows that kind of decision-making in the hands of an Indigenous people is life-saving. I don't hear this mentioned in the discussion. It's all about redressing the evils, the invasion, the genocide, the massacres, the lack of reparation for what was stolen and done. And that truth-seeking is mightily important. But the reason, the compelling reason to give voice to the First Peoples in Australia is the global evidence says this is the transformational idea. If you give local Aboriginal communities and peak organisations that are genuinely democratically representing those communities, you in fact move the story in a very positive way. So you will see in those settings where there is a kind of sovereign voice, a genuine control over their destiny, those communities have very, very rapidly closed those gaps that here seemed to be stubborn every year. Life expectancy, the health and opportunities for children, all of those very fundamental human rights can be improved by local decision making. There is a huge unmet potential in the Aboriginal communities to really get on with doing this work themselves. You've got to invest in it and then empower them and they could do it. So in New South Wales, where I live, out in the western parts of the state, they have a very well-run, good governance organisation called Muddy Parkey, led by Des Jones, an Aboriginal man who works on a sort of a unity of purpose approach. Let's get all of the voices from other communities in that part of the state. And then it's a quite modern democratic form, really, of the traditional structure to give voice to those people down at the grassroots. Now, if you can build on that idea, state governments can do it. State governments could negotiate any kind of legal agreement. We'll call it a treaty or a compact. And you can work your way up to the more difficult and stubborn question that we've never resolved in Australia. How do we truly put right the damage that was done? And in that constitution, which is very stained with the old white Australia racist language, we not only remove the racist language, but we get a constitution that genuinely affords the human rights to every person walking this Aboriginal land.
And is there a roadmap to achieving that by following the Uluru Statement from the Heart?
Uluru was widely representative in terms of a consultation process among Aboriginal people in many parts of the country. But you may have seen the stories that have emerged since showing the wide-ranging political views among First Nations people in Australia. So this is the difficulty. You can put forward a roadmap, even with a democratically appointed group, but there will be some communities in some corners of the country that feel, well, they didn't ask me what I think. And that really goes with any kind of consultative approach to these things. So I think you have to see it more rather than a blueprint which says this is what is going to happen. You have to see it as an ongoing series of negotiations, a contest of ideas, and really multiple voices. Not all of the voices that are heard most prominently represent what people in some communities think. But it's the same for any issue I can think of. The most pressing things in the world have contested views. We should not be discouraged and think, well, after Uluru and the federal government's rather blunt and humiliating rejection of that leadership group, that this can't move forward. Once you go to the reality that everyone can have an opinion about constitutional change and voice, and every First Nations person can have an opinion, and we should not be expecting that somehow miraculously that there would be an immediate consensus. Why don't we work calmly towards the evidence that says, well, what really would make things better, not just for some, but for the health and well-being of what is really an extraordinary opportunity we have in Australia to address our remaining persistent poverty within the heartland of the country, and then our equality, our ability to work together, our diversity of ideas is not a weakness then. We're not fighting one another like most parts of the world I travel to. We would in fact be working on a sense of what is the common good. I don't expect we're going to have some political settlement that will seem like the Ten Commandments for politicians in Canberra. You know, that's been a big part of the problem, Bill. The expectations are lifted over and over again for Aboriginal people. The politicians are good at promises and raising hopes, and usually after an election or a little bit down the road, those hopes are crushed, really betrayed, and I think that sets us back. So I keep my ear on the voices of community as well as the strategic people trying to come up with that blueprint, and I recognise that it's a long road. Some wise Aboriginal people said that to me when I was very young in the 60s, looking at the civil rights, the land rights struggles going on in the street. And one old fella said to me, the road to freedom is a very long road. And I've always remembered that counsel.
Yes, unfortunately so. And we're speaking today with Jeff McMullen, journalist, author and filmmaker, on really some of the biggest issues facing Australia, the reconciliation with our First Peoples. Jeff, we've reached the stage of the show where we ask our guests to pick a song. Now, you've picked Is That What You Heard by Neil Murray. I'm just wondering why you picked that one.
I was travelling with Neil and some Aboriginal painters, and we were looking at where the Endeavour sailed in 1770, but we were looking this time at the Aboriginal view of how those events unfolded. So we were sitting around one night, and Neil, with his guitar, picked out this song, and I asked him, what is the song inspired by? And he said, loss, a loss that you can't imagine, a loss close to family hearts. And then a child that says, what is that sound that I'm hearing? Is it the one we lost? I think the song is a very beautiful, intimate story about listening to what a child says.
You are standing there before me, and I feel your solemn need for an answer to the question that we all must need. You want to know what happens when we die. You want to know if our spirit will survive. Or does the little one that lives inside our breast, does it fly away when the big one's laid to rest? Yes, I believe. I believe it does. Where does that little one go? Some say they don't know. Some say it goes to the sea, and some say it lives in the trees, crying sadly like a bird. Until it's received by someone with the greatest need. Thank you. Now you tell me that you've heard at night something like a bird, sad crying in the trees. And you want to know why you hear it, 'cause it makes you cry and you're afraid to go near it. And could it be your brother's spirit crying sadly in the tree?
That was Is That What You Heard by Neil Murray, a song specially chosen for us today by our guest Jeff McMullen. Jeff, Bruce Pascoe's book Dark Emu, well, first of all, he dismisses some of the enormous fictions that we've confronted, the Terra Nullius, the hunter-gatherer, and he talks about how in Australia we've got a history that goes back now at least 80,000 years. We've got so much to be proud of with the Aboriginal people. I'm wondering, is that what first drew you to the Aboriginal cause?
I think the glaring injustice opened my eyes, and when I saw it was a worldwide pattern, I felt at home. I wanted to learn more and understand, why is it like this? Why is this part of the longer timelines of Australian history almost erased? What Bruce Pascoe and Dark Emu have done, and we could throw into the discussion having a non-Indigenous historian like Bill Gammage, who wrote The Biggest Estate on Earth. It's not black or white history, it's truthful history. And that was left out of our Australian story when I was a child, and I think I had to find out by listening to Aboriginal people that explained to me that they would point out that they had vast areas under cultivation. It was what the writers have called farming without fences. And I think Bruce Pascoe's eloquent expression by using the oral history, but also the accounts of white settlers and so-called explorers and discoverers, was really that there was technology and inventiveness, the eel farms, the fish traps, the clever engineering of solutions to, as you say, civilizing human growth story here that we have never really fully acknowledged. It's amazing, Bill, that since Bruce wrote his book, I heard him talking on radio one day, and he mentioned that down on the Victorian coastline, a recent archaeological discovery and the carbon dating of a human hearth, so like a fireside cooking setup, indicates it could be as much as 120,000 years of human settlement, which tells us that what Bruce is saying in Dark Emu is correct. Here, you can imagine the first Aboriginal woman to make bread using the native grasses, the seeds of things here, long before Egypt as a civilization existed. I think if you start to see the wonder of that story, you realize there is a unique heritage here that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have been offering us with open arms. And I think you are quite correct. That is the starting point. When we discover that knowledge system, you see it as part of a bigger human story. I mean, it's a marvel that we've got art still on the walls of rock galleries and pictographs, you know, etchings into the rock over in Western Australia that are over 40,000 years old, far older than most of the expressions of civilized people around the world. This is the story of humans learning, thriving, adapting, and doing it better than just about anywhere else I've been.
Yes, I think we've said sorry, but we haven't yet said thanks. Maybe that's the next stage. But it's a big question, but where would you like to see us get to in our relationship with Aboriginal people?
We need a new relationship, and it begins with that acknowledgement, recognition, and really a deep, heartfelt appreciation that this is the growth of an intellectual knowledge system over a vast amount of time that amounts to what I would say is 21st century custodianship. offering us in the 21st century the foundations for how to build the most hopeful society, I think, something that all of humanity needs to see. Custodianship is 21st century earth science. If you walk this country, Aboriginal people would say, you have a responsibility to nurture all of the interconnected systems of life. That is not airy fairy at all. It's an obligation. So in recognizing that that is Indigenous knowledge, we make the most important shift in our thinking. Instead of patronizing them, like Cook did when he sailed into Botany Bay, well, he writes in his journal, these people have no inequality of condition. They are at one with the land that they walk on, with no inequality of condition. So I think we're still really trying to catch up to where Lieutenant James Cook was at the end of that voyage, and to realize that by listening, by recognizing, and then allowing Aboriginal voice, there's the way ahead for a much brighter future for everyone here.
I just want to have a personal thank you to you, Jeff. You've been working this area for so long, and you've had all sorts of setbacks, and yet you're still fired up with the enthusiasm and still kicking wonderful goals. So just on behalf of Dads on the Air, thank you personally for all the work you've done.
Good on you, Bill. It's very warm of you. But I've got to say, every one of us really has the same opportunity. We've all got a voice. We can all do some little things. You can get to know the people in your own area. You can offer to sit down and have a yarn and listen and see if there are things to do. And it's in the same approach that you take on your program. It's realizing in a way that every kid, these are our children. I make it very simple. It's a better way to live. It makes you a stronger human being. And I truly believe we are closer to a great society here than anywhere else I've been in all of those years of world wandering. The yarn with you.
Well, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners too. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So it just remains for me to give a very special and warm thank you to our guest, Jeff McMullen. Jeff, thank you very much for being on Dads on the Air.
All the best to you, Bill, and to everyone.
And we'll be back next week with another show.